It's a pleasure to be back in Santa Barbara. After a long time, I'd forgotten just how beautiful it is here. And I want to thank the organisers for giving me this opportunity to speak. I'm going to tell you about some work that I've been doing with my graduate students, Leonidi Benincasa and David Rideout, who's at UC San Diego, so your neighbour there. But on the way to, in describing this work and presenting the results, I will also sketch out a particular point of view on black hole thermodynamics and quantum gravity in general, which I find compelling, that I hope to, that you will find it at least coherent and stimulating. So here are some ideas to take away with you at the end of the talk. Really, there's only one idea, and that's causality. Causality, causality, causality. And what I mean by causality is relativistic causality. So a Galilean space-time has a causal structure. It's pretty trivial. But I don't mean that. I don't just mean that. I mean specifically relativistic causality. So this is causality, causality, causality. So and these points are listed in order of decreasing certainty for me, and probably for you. So the first point is that black hole, to take away, is that black hole entropy, or an idea to think about, is that black hole entropy, the sister entropy, etc., are examples of a general phenomenon of causal horizon entropy. I'll define what a causal horizon is in a minute. And the horizon, the horizon that we have to understand, and if we understood that, then we would understand them all, is Rimmer. The second point to take away is that the microscopic degrees of freedom in quantum gravity are discrete causal relations. And the third point to take away is that kinematically, the entropy of a horizon is the number of nearest neighbor causal relations that cross the horizon. And what I mean by kinematically is that I mean the statement in the same sense as the statement that the entropy of a gas is up to some numerical factor, some logarithmic factor that depends on the temperature, etc. The entropy of a gas is the is just the number of molecules. Okay. All right, so I'm going to lay out here some basic assumptions that I'm going to make in this in the work that I'm going to show you. And I'm not going to argue for them by other means than just showing you this slide. Okay. So here are the basic ideas that everything, the rest of the talk is based on. So black hole thermodynamics is due to the causal nature of the horizon. The fact that it divides space-time into two pieces. The interior, if you like, of the horizon is a region of space-time that cannot signal causally to the exterior. So the horizon is associated with a causal dichotomy of space-time. And black hole thermodynamics arises because of this. And in particular, this is particularly apparent when you think about the generalized second law. So for example, Hawking's area theorem, that is the second law of thermodynamics in the classical limit when h bar goes to zero. What's left of the generalized second law is Hawking's area theorem. And when you think about the proof of the area theorem, it's written in causal terms that the horizon is defined as the boundary of the causal path described above. It's all causal. Another piece of evidence is that there are violations of the generalized second law when you don't have relativistic causal structure. So I'm thinking in particular of work by Elling, Foster, Jacobson, and Wall, which shows that in theories where you have Lorentz violation, for example, bimetric theories where you have, say, two maximum speeds of propagation, you can actually violate the generalized second law. And there's also work by Aaron Wall that shows that if you ascribe the area of the horizon as its entropy, then for, if you do that for apparent or dynamical horizons, not the event horizon, but the apparent or dynamical horizons, again, you can violate the generalized second law. So that's the first thing that I'm going to assume, that the black hole thermodynamics is due to the causal nature of the horizon. The second point is that all causal horizons obey the laws of thermodynamics. And what I mean by a causal horizon is the boundary of the causal past to the future inextendable, and I think you have to put infinite here, time-like curve, so I mean one of infinite proper length. This definition, I think, first appeared in a paper by Gary and Stephen Hawking. And so this definition of a causal horizon includes the black hole horizon. So if this time-like trajectory remains always outside the black hole, then the boundary of the causal past of that observer is indeed the black hole horizon, the event horizon. The de Sitter horizon is similarly the boundary of the causal past of some observer who lives forever in de Sitter space-time. And the Rindler horizon is the boundary of the causal past of some constantly accelerated observer. And we should think fundamentally about horizon entropy, causal horizon entropy, and not black hole entropy or de Sitter entropy or anything that's specific to any particular one of these examples, but just about the horizon itself. And this point of view is set out beautifully in a paper by Ted Jacobson and Bruno Parentani. And they present the evidence that it's not just black hole horizons, but it's the horizons and Rindler horizons that obey all the laws of thermodynamics. Okay. So this beautiful unity, yes.
I'm just a bit confused. I thought that the quasi-local horizons also did obey the area theorem.
So all I know is that Aaron's study is in a semi-classical context, so he's including quantum effects of fields in a space-time. And his examples, I think, are two-dimensional examples, but I'm not too sure about them. I can't quite remember about that. So it may be that when you include quantum effects, then the generalized second law fails to hold. That's good. Yeah.
Yeah, just to be clear. So is your talk in the context of a sort of semi-classical treatment where you have basically classical space-time and
no, it's not.
You think of this as more fundamentally a property of quantum gravity?
Yes.
Okay, because
I do.
You do? Okay, because I mean, there is the issue that's always in the back of my mind is, you know, what happens when you have a real sort of superposition of, you know, space-times with very different causal structures, and you think that causal horizons still make sense? And
I do think that. So you'll see that the talk is sort of in the context of a semi-classical picture in which there is a good approximation to what's really going on, but what's really going on is not merely a continuum space-time. Ask me the question again. But are there other questions? If you take this point of view seriously, that there is this unity, and that the laws of thermodynamics are unified in this way to apply to all causal horizons, then horizon entropy does not count internal states, because there's just no such thing as an internal, well, it's hard to imagine what an internal state might mean for the case of a Rindler horizon, for example. But the horizon entropy is associated to the horizon itself, and this point of view has been argued for eloquently by Ted, and is also associated particularly with Raphael's author. Okay. And then the final point that I'm going to assume but not argue more for is that without a physical cutoff, the entropy of a black hole would be infinite. And probably the strongest evidence for that is all the calculations of entanglement entropy. The entanglement entropy of a quantum field in a black hole background, say, must at least contribute to the black hole entropy, if it's not all of the black hole entropy, it must at least contribute. And we know that in calculations of that entanglement entropy, as we take the short distance cutoff to zero, the entropy, that entanglement entropy diverges. So without a physical cutoff, the entropy would actually be infinite, but we know that it's not infinite. We know the answer, we know the physical finite answer. And that physical finite answer for the black hole entropy implies that the cutoff scale, the physical cutoff scale, is the Planck scale. And again, Black Hole has argued strongly for this conclusion. Okay. So, as I say, there's prima facie evidence for this picture, and I'm going to just take that evidence at face value, take it seriously, and ask, well, if we seek now the statistical mechanical understanding, description of explanation of horizon thermodynamics, where does taking that evidence seriously lead us? Well, in order to implement a physical cutoff at Planckian scales, that means that space-time has no structure on scales smaller than the Planck length. And the easiest way to model a space-time which has no structure on smaller than Planckian scales is to go discrete. To think of space-time as fundamentally discrete. It just has no structure. It's atomic, and down at those scales, the atomic structure is the only description. There's no structure to space-time at smaller than those scales. Okay, so we go discrete, but we're going to hold fast to relativistic causal order. That means that we're not allowed any lattices. No lattices allowed. We're not going to allow order one Lorentz violation in the UV, to use a phrase that appeared in Joe. So that's out. No lattices, no order one Lorentz violation in the UV. We're going to cleave to relativistic causal order, but try to go discrete.
Is there some Lorentz violation?
No, not in, but you're, in the structure that I'm going to set out for you. There is no Lorentz violation intrinsic to the discrete structure. It may be that Lorentz violation arises by some other means, but it's not inherent in the discrete structure. Let me show you what it is. Okay, so we're going to hold on to relativistic causal structure, but try to have a discrete model of space-time in which this is still there. So let's think a little bit about causal structure in the continuum first. Well, there, it turns out we're in really, really good shape. So you know that the causal structure of the continuum space-time cannot encode the full geometry of a space-time, because if you do a conformal transformation from one space-time to another, the causal structure, the causal order, on the points of the space-time remains the same. So you take a space-time, do a conformal transformation, the two space-times have the same causal order. So causal order can't give you the full geometry. But astonishingly enough, it gives you everything else, everything up to that one function's worth of uncertainty. Okay. So the causal order encodes the geometry of a continuum space-time, which is strongly causal. And that's a causality condition that's stronger, as it suggests, than just the absence of closed causal loops, up to your conformal factor. So the space-time causal order unifies within itself topology. If you know the causal order, you can tell the topology of space-time. If you know the causal order, you can tell the differentiable structure of the space-time, and if you know the causal order, you can tell you know 9/10 of the metric in four dimensions. So in four dimensions, you have the metric is 10 functions worth of information, and the conformal factor is one function. So you know nine. You know the rest, 9/10. You can actually weaken this condition of strongly causal to a condition which is a slightly weaker causality condition called distinguishing. But I chose to write strongly causal here because if you ask me to sketch the proof of this, I can just about do it in the case of for strongly causal rents in space-time. It's much more complicated to do it for distinguishing space-time. And I've picked up, and this result incorporates a lot of work on global causal structure, causal analysis, I'll call it. And I picked out this particular one to attribute to Stephen, because this is the hard step, right? You can know that the topology is encoded in the causal structure. The open sets are associated to causal intervals, for example. To show that the causal structure gives you the differentiable structure, that's the hard thing. Stephen proved it very, very early in his career, and it's a beautiful Hawking-like proof which mere mortals have to struggle over to to reproduce, but it's astonishing and lovely. And once you have the topology and the differential structure and you have the tangent space, this proof is half a page in Hawking and Utz. Right? So the causal order encodes an enormous amount of geometrical information. Not just geometrical, but it encodes manifold information. Okay.
When Hawking was describing this, he presumably was not thinking of a discrete space-time.
No.
He had a continuum space-time.
Exactly. We need the theorems in the continuum.
Yeah. So what are you starting with? So you're recovering the manifold structure. So what do you have before you recover the manifold structure?
The theorem assumes that you have a Lorentzian space-time. It assumes you have two Lorentzian space-times. So... And it assumes that there's a causal bijection between the two. So there's a map which preserves the causal ordering. But it's assuming that you have the Lorentzian spacetimes. But it shows you that if all you know is the causal order on the spacetime, then it fixes all these things. So it is a theorem of the continuum. You're not starting with just some point set, which has no structure. We're saying you have a Lorentzian space-time. But if someone tells you what the causal structure is, that is geometrical information. Are there other questions?
It's a specifically Lorentzian causal structure.
Yes, it's specifically Lorentzian. It's minus, plus, 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 plus. And it works for any dimension greater than or equal to certainly four. Possibly it works for three dimensions, but yes, it works for three, but not for two.
But you're not claiming that in the discrete two continuum case, the causal order gives you the differentiable structure. I mean, presumably there are some details about the map that, in the discrete case, that would affect the differentiable structure.
So, in the discrete case, I suppose fundamentally there is no differentiable structure as such. The idea is that, as I'll answer your question and then I'll say it again as I go down the slide. The idea is that a discrete manifold can have a continuum approximation, and the differentiable structure in that continuum approximation will be fixed, approximately of course, will be fixed by the causal order, the discrete causal order in the underlying discrete map. That's the idea.
But there could also be discrete causal orders which had no continuum.
Absolutely. They're absolutely right. And in fact, most discrete orders have nothing to do with manifolds at all. So it's a very special set of all the discrete orders which have manifold-like, which have a manifold approximation. Yeah, indeed. That's right. Okay. So,
I don't know what is special about the planimetric. You see, you could have a causal order determined by some Finsler structure, and you just have to give a cone in the tangent space. But what the cone is up to you as far as causal structure is concerned. So, causal structure is a much more general concept than just the Lorentzian causal structure. So, why do you adhere so strongly to the metric?
I don't know. I don't know anything about Finsler geometry. So,
but if you just give a smooth cone, So the complex count of the tangents.
Is it a partial order?
It gives you a fairly partial order. You just copy line for line, Xerox copying it from most of its work, and you'll pick up a more generalized notion of causality. I'm not advocating, Finzelerian causal structure, for example, or in a general way. But somehow, by emphasizing the causality, you're also emphasizing the Lorentzian and metric structure.
Yes, I am. So in the continuum, the causal order is not everything. You need to add something else to get the full geometry back. And one way you can think about what you have to add is the volume information. So if you add the information about how much space-time volume there is in every region, then, or if, in other words, if you put in the volume measure or the square root of minus g, if you like, then you have the whole geometry. So you can express that as the slogan, the order in causal structure, causal order, plus volume equals geometry in the continuum. Okay. So in a discrete manifold, can you see this? Sorry, it's bottom left. In a discrete manifold, you get that information about volume for free because you can count elements. And this was anticipated or pointed out by Riemann in his inaugural lecture. He said that in a discrete manifold, it carries metric information. A discrete manifold carries metric information within itself, whereas a continuous manifold needs to have metric imposed on it from the outside.
So in this case, how do you view discretization? What is now the concrete definition of the discrete manifold that we're using?
I'll show you in a minute.
Okay.
So in a discrete manifold, you can, if it has an order, then you can use number to give you volume information. And this slogan becomes this one, order plus number equals geometry. So you replace volume information by simply number information. But with that, you don't have to add in from the outside. The discrete manifold carries that information itself. And this is Raphael Zorkin's slogan that he has coined for this situation. Order plus number now can equal geometry. Okay. Well, Lorentzian space-time, the claim is, can be encoded in nothing more than a discrete causal order or a causal set. And this proposal was made independently by Etoft, by Jan Nierheim, and by Bombelli, Lee, Meyer, and Sorkin, and has been championed particularly by Raphael Sorkin in the recent past. Okay, are there questions? Yes.
So you input also some scale, right? Like something to associate to a number. Mock up for what you lost with not having the volume.
Yes, the idea, there's a scale, but the scale is one in fundamental units. But the idea is that that scale will be of order the Planck scale, but we don't know the order one ratio between the fundamental scale and the actual Planck length, if you like, so that we don't know. But the idea is that it's of order, the conjecture is that it's of order the Planck length.
So you said that Lorentz symmetry is not violated.
Right.
How does it work?
Yes, let me show you. So instead of giving you the formal definition of the causal set, I'm going to just show you one. Okay. So this is a causal set, and I'll tell you exactly how it is, what it is in a minute. But it's a causal set to which what two-dimensional Minkowski space-time is a good approximation. Okay. Now, how did I make... So what do I do to make this causal set? Well, it's a set of points, and those are a set of elements. And the elements of my causal set are these red... represented by these red crosses. And what I did was, by a random process, a Poisson process, at a certain density, I distributed these points in 1 plus 1 dimensional Minkowski space-time. So it's a random distribution, and that's absolutely crucial and absolutely key to why this is a Lorentz invariant discrete structure. Okay. So I, So these are a random distribution of roughly 256 elements. And then what I do is, well, I list them. So I write a list of these elements. I just give them a name, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and list them. And then I write a second list, which is the list of pairs of elements which are causally related. So in particular, I write the pair this one and that one, right? Or this one and that one, and this one and that one. So it's a whole list of pairs of elements which are causally related. And I've drawn on this site, yes.
So that means they are on the same light cone?
No. No, it means they're time light related.
Okay. So inside the light cone.
Yes, indeed. So there's probability zero for them to actually land, one to land on the light cone of the other. Right. So they're all time light related. Okay. But what you've noticed is that most of the other thing that I've done on this diagram is that I've not drawn, so I've drawn a line when two elements are causally related, but I haven't drawn it if they're causally related via something in the middle, right? So this one is causally related to that one, but there's no line drawn here because this is causally related to that one via a chain of other elements. So the only relations that I've drawn on here with green lines are irreducible causal relations, which we call links. They're the nearest neighbor causal relations that are not encoded in any of the other causal relations. Right? So the green lines are links, and you're not to think of them as having any length. Right? The idea is that the only information that we're keeping is one bit of information, the fact that they are related. And that's it. There's no length, even though this line obviously has both a Euclidean and a Lorentzian length, right? So there's the Euclidean length that you see on this picture, but that there's the Lorentzian time-like distance between them, which is very small. So Steve has noticed is that almost all of these links are very, very close to null. And that's Lorentzian geometry, right? This shows you it. Here's my description of this picture. This is what Minkowski spacetime is like. I've put brackets here because I think this is what Minkowski spacetime is, but it's at least a picture of what Minkowski spacetime is like. So this picture shows you how amazing Lorentzian spacetime really is, and it's something that you don't take to heart, if you like. Usually, because whenever we draw a space-time or whenever we think about a space-time, we put on it in our minds a Euclidean geometry, but it's not like that at all. This diagram shows you that this point is just as close to that one as it is to this one. They're roughly one Planck time apart. That's it, that's ready. Yes. Yes.
So I have a fundamental confusion. If I were to apply a conformal factor to your picture, then I would mess up the equidistribution somehow. So probably you're going to tell me that if I did a different selection of random points, I would mimic that one. And so does that mean that everything on the discrete side has to be averaged over some collection of spacetimes?
You have to coarse grain, but you can coarse grain within an individual discrete spacetime. So it's true.
How can number recover the same information as the conformal factor?
If this spacetime, so this is Minkowski spacetime, so this the distribution of elements reflects the area measure, which is uniform. It's Euclidean. It's the Euclidean area measure, right? So if I draw some region like this, the number of elements in here is proportional to that area, right? If I wanted to approximate find a discrete structure to which a non-flat two-dimensional space-time was a good approximation to, there would be a different measure on this, a different area measure, right? The square root of minus 2 would not be 1 in these coordinates.
But the causal structure might still be the same.
The causal structure will be the same. So the way that you would do that is, let's say the volume, the area of this region is very large, whereas the area of this region is very small by the because of the conformal factor. Then that you would choose a lot of, randomly again, but you would choose a lot of elements here, very few elements here, but the causal structure would be the same. So the way that you decide whether or not elements are related to each other is exactly this one.
The discrete causal structure changes, but the approximating space-time causal structure is the same. I mean, I have different collections of points.
Yes, it will be a different underlying discrete manifold.
Yeah.
When you do, so I'm coming back to my question.
Yes.
When you do a Lorentz transformation, what happens?
Absolutely. So the Lorentz transformation is a squashing in this null direction and a stretching in that null direction. Okay. But the amazing and slightly counterintuitive thing about the discrete, about a random distribution like this, is that it's invariant under any area preserving map.
In a statistical sense?
Yes, of course, the points move, right?
Okay.
But the,
then
the,
I come back to my
original. No. Let me finish. And that's why it's important that this distribution is random, okay? Because so if you do that, then the uniformity of this distribution is the same. Okay? But if this were a lattice, it wouldn't be the same because you would get bunching up in one direction and stretching out in another direction. And what looks uniform in one frame is not uniform in another frame. But a random distribution is uniform in all frames.
But you said this has to be in a statistical context, because if you take a single configuration.
No. Let me ask you this question. So think about the molecules in this room.
Yes. Right?
They're randomly distributed.
Yes.
Right? They have random positions.
Yes.
Is the configuration of molecules in this room invariant in the Euclidean transformation? In some sense, it's not, right? It's not invariant because you do a rotation, the molecules move, right? But the continuum description of the air in this room is invariant under the
Euclidean transformation. So there must be a parameter that you take to zero that determines for you at what level the statistical average of what you're doing is equal to the actual continuum value.
No, you're saying at what coarse grain scale does the continuum picture kick in?
Exactly.
Okay.
So what this means, coming back to the Lorentz federation, this means that there is a parameter that parameterizes for you a Lorentz federation.
No.
Okay.
There's no frame here. There's nothing inherent in this discrete structure that picks out a frame. So there can be no Lorentz violation in the continuum approximation.
No, but if you look at the set of symmetries of your 256 points that preserves this causal ordering, then that's some subgroup of some permutation group that bears no resemblance to the Lorentz group or to the Poincaré group at these scales. It's only after you average over this ensemble of causal order of these causal sets that you recover Lorentz invariance.
No, that's not the case. An individual.
I think I can clear this up.
Yes.
In the example of the air in this room, when you say that it's invariant under rotations in some sense, I think what you have in mind is that you're averaging over some small volumes. And using, if you look at actual locations of molecules,
yes,
it will change. But
indeed,
you're imagining there's some small, on a macroscopic scale volume, that you can average over for this particular configuration.
For that particular
right.
configuration.
So it's not a statistical ensemble through the ensemble, but it's a coarse grain strain.
Yes, it's a coarse grain.
So there's some effective coarse graining.
But I think the whole point of the claim is that there's no Lorentz violation at the first scale. And I think that was the first point on the previous slide, right?
I'm not saying there is even a meaning to Lorentz invariance at the Planck scale in the sense that there's no Lorentz transformation. It's a discrete entity. Lorentz transformations make no sense on a discrete thing. Right?
Good,
what I'm saying is that no Lorentz violation in the continuum approximation can arise or is forced on you by this structure.
Let me rephrase.
Whereas it is for a lattice.
Let me rephrase the question in a way.
Can I go on?
The reason that this is an important point.
Let's take one and discuss this.
So let me just make a comment why this point is actually important.
Okay.
The reason is that we have experimental proof from many experiments that the amount of violation of Lorentz invariance at the Planck scale can only be very, very small. This is from low energy experiments, and this whole controversy about the faster than light neutrinos and so on was focusing on them. So in this case, even if you have a very small Lorentz violation at the Planck scale, this is experimentally excluded. That's why
you're thinking about it in the you're thinking about it in the wrong way. I staked my career on Lorentz invariance, right? There's a signed affidavit held by my colleague Nico Gilini, which says that if they discover Lorentz violation, I'm gonna give up physics and take up something else. But this issue is absolutely crucial to the further into, you know, to whether I carry on doing physics tomorrow or not, right? I thought about it a lot. And let's argue about it later. Alright, so this is a causal set, right? It's a set of elements, and it has what's called mathematically a partial order on it, meaning that there is a relation, which is often written precedes. This just means that x causally precedes y. It's transitive, so this implies that x precedes x. And there are no closed loops in this relation. That's the definition, mathematical definition of partial order. This is also discrete, Lorentzian space-time, a causal Lorentzian space-time is a partial order also, but this is a discrete partial order in the sense that if you take any two elements, ask about the causal interval between them, there'll be finitely many elements in that causal interval. So that's the definition of a causal set. But this is what it's really like. This is the kind of causal set that Minkowski space-time is like. Most causal sets have nothing to do with manifolds. So in fact, we know a lot about what most causal sets are like, and they're horribly non-manifold-like, indeed.
Back to Gary's earlier question, you're trying to do something very fundamental here, but it looks like you're still making contact always with semi-classical space-time. So the density of these points depended on there being an actual measure over that.
So the way I got this causal set is by approximating a continuum manifold. And indeed, the idea is you now take away that approximating manifold, forget that. The only thing you have is this set and this relation. And that's it. That you don't have any information. The idea is that in itself encodes the geometry, okay? And if I want to know the time-like distance between two elements, then I just count the number I think about all possible chains through the causal set that can get from one to the other, and I take the longest one. And the length of that longest chain, that's the time-like distance.
So if I had a macroscopic superposition of two different space-times, would I get a superposition of two different causal sets?
The other way around. So it would be a superposition of causal sets, and that would have no semi-classical, that will have no semi-classical meaning. Oh, so finally, this is incredibly non-local, right? You can see that it's so unlattice-like. Every element has, in an infinite Minkowski space-time, an element would have infinitely many nearest neighbors. It would have links stretching up the light cone forever and ever, and there would be infinitely many elements which are just as close to this one as the others. So it's inherently non-local, and that's the price you pay for cleaving desperately to Lorentz, fundamentally to Lorentz invariance, and going discrete. And those two things, the price that you pay for keeping those is that it has to be non-local in this way. Okay, that will come back. All right. So proposal sets a discrete and random variant, and let's argue about that later. And the proposal is that discrete, so the proposal of a theory of quantum gravity based on them is that discrete causal relations are the microscopic degrees of freedom in quantum gravity. And for every Lorentzian space-time, continuum space-time, there are many causal sets to which M is the continuum approximation. That process is a random process. You get one causal set every time you run that process. So these causal sets are gotten mathematically by this random Poisson process of sprinkling into M at using the volume measure at this density rho, where and rho goes like L to minus D in D dimensions, where L is the fundamental length of order the Planck length. Here's causal set quantum gravity in one line. Partition function for causal sets of size n with n elements corresponding to a space-time of a certain fixed volume is given by a sum over all causal sets of size n, most of which are completely unmanifold like, weighted by, let's say, e to the I s for the causal set, where s is the action for an individual causal set. And the major question in causal set quantum gravity and in all discrete approaches to quantum gravity is how to overcome the huge entropic weights of all the non-manifold-like configurations that you get. Once you relax the condition of continuity, you open the door to enormous numbers of completely non-manifold-like things, discrete manifolds, but you want the sum to be dominated by the manifold-like ones if we're going to recover semi-classical physics from it. So this is an example in this discrete context, that's the cosmological constant problem. The physics wants to have structure on the smallest possible scale. In fact, there's only one scale here. So he wants to have structure on that scale, and that's illustrated by all the vast majority of these causal sets are just nothing like manifolds. They have structure on Planckian scales. So this has to be really special, the action in this primal struggle between action and entropy, this action has to be really special to overcome this entropic weight of all the non-manifold-like discrete things.
So may I think of C as just the set of directed graphs?
Directed acyclic graphs, indeed. This should be set of all C's.
No, I'm not complaining about that, but I mean, basically the set we're asked to contemplate is all directed graphs.
Acyclic. Yes, of size n, say, if you fix the volume.
N means the number of vertices in the graph. So it's very much like Lenny's picture here earlier, right?
Yes. Lenny drew a causal set.
He drew a causal set. Yeah. Or a set of causal sets. Yes.
Okay, so
but most of those graphs, I mean, perhaps to draw it up, most of those graphs presumably are not even planar, or not even things that have an embedding into.
Right, most of them can't be embedded into any Lorentzian manifold at all. They can't be even embedded, let alone.
Yeah, I mean, the examples you've given all had their causal structure induced from a privileged embedding into a rather simple mind,
Yeah. I'm not saying this is easy to do.
And so your action will select out a dimension of smooth approximation? Is that part of the idea?
That's part of the idea. We haven't achieved this.
I understand. But you would have different actions to select out different dimensions of space-time manifolds.
The hope would be eventually that there wouldn't be such, that there would just be one theory and that the dimension of space-time would come out of
D that. D might be a parameter then? I mean, oh, I see. You're going to get four dimensions out.
Possibly. That's possible. But I'm going to show you an action actually later which does have which is a one parameter family of actions, with one for each dimension actually. But
S is a real number.
Yes.
Which is constructed from the graph.
Yes. Yes. I'll show you some examples of it. Yes, for
instance. But in Lenny's case, P was true, the number of branches and years is infinite, right?
Yes.
Doesn't have to be.
So So, yeah, Lenny's causal set would not,
in this sense,
have a good continuum approximation. I mean, Lenny's nodes were not in, were not sort of events in space-time, but they were whole causal patches, if you like to.
But you're thinking the same thing. In full space-time, your number of branches.
Yes.
She has n, so she's taking a finite.
Yes, yes. The valency of this, the valency, is that right? Of this graph is, not, yeah, is huge. Yeah. Yes.
So you worked very hard to get the Lorentz structure on a particular causal set, but now you're allowing correlations or superpositions between different causal sets. So can you not still have some quantum influences that violate Lorentz invariants? I mean, degrees of freedom or the atoms here correlated with atoms.
Good. Okay. So you could say, can there be an acausal dynamics on this kinematical causal structure? Yes, you could. But you could use causality as a principle to restrict your possible dynamics. Can I go on?
Yeah.
I don't want to keep
partly
to get work done. And he said, don't go on too long because I've got to do some work. So. Because this quantum gravity is. It's new to many of you. I've had one comment about what it's not. Right. It's not loop quantum gravity. Loop quantum gravity has no causal order at all. It's not spin foams, although that is a sort of discrete approach to quantum gravity. Spin foams and other simplicial complex space approaches are lattice-like. So this is not a lattice. It's nothing like anything that's based on a simplicial complex. It's not causal dynamical triangulations. That's defined in the continuum limit, where the discreteness scale is taken to zero. And the actual discretization is supposed to not matter and not be physical. Here, causal sets keep the discreteness scale finite. We're not taking the continuum limit. When we talk about recovering semi-classical physics, we're talking about recovering it in a continuum approximation. And a continuum approximation to what's really going on, which is discrete. Right. So, horizons. So, with this picture of a more fundamental description of space-time, let's now embed the idea of a horizon in this, kinematically in this framework. So, the idea is that a continuum space-time with a causal horizon is an approximation to a causal set, which is the underlying microstructure. Okay, this is all kinematics, and now I'm just going to ignore quantum theory of causal sets. And I'm going to pretend that space-time just is one causal set. I don't believe that, and it's not the final answer. We're going to have to struggle with this sum over all causal sets and interpret things in the light of the quantum theory of causal sets. But I want you to take this in the same way that we take the statement that things are made of atoms. It's the same kind of statement, same kind of claim. So we're going to analyze horizon entropy in a kinematical framework in which we assume that the space-time is fundamentally this causal set. In a causal set, the analog of a time-like curve is just a chain. It's just a chain of elements, each one to the causal future of the last. And a causal horizon can then be identified not with a surface, because there's nothing continuum in a causal set, nothing continuous like a surface. It's identified with a partition of the causal set into two pieces. And that can be identified fundamentally from the causal structure. You have this chain. You can identify the elements which are in its causal path, so you know what set of elements you're talking about. And you just divide the causal set into that piece, the past, the causal past of this chain, and its complement. Right? And that's the horizon. The horizon is the partition. It corresponds to this partition. Okay. And I'm going to assume that we know what we mean by a hypersurface sigma, a three-dimensional space-like hypersurface, which intersects the horizon and on which we want to evaluate the entropy. That, getting space-like things in a causal set is much more tricky, difficult. But I'm just going to assume that hypersurface, a space like hypersurface, is similarly associated with a partition of the causal set into two, into the elements which are to the future of the hypersurface and the elements which are to the past of the hypersurface. I'm just going to assume that. All right, and then to investigate, for example, a Rindler horizon, what we're going to do is consider all causal sets that Minkowski space that Minkowski space approximates. In other words, all of the causal sets you can get by sprinkling into by doing that process of Poisson sampling the space-time and reading off the causal relation, all of them. And then everything that I say from now on in the talk will be about averages over sprinkling. Fluctuations are very, if we can't get the average right, then it's, you know, the idea, the proposal will fail. But fluctuations are very important, but I'm going to just totally ignore them here. So hopefully we'll get the average right, and then we can think about fluctuations. So what does the horizon entropy count? And again, this is kinematics only. Of the same status as the statement that the entropy of gas is the number of molecules. So there was an idea proposed by Jamal Du and Raphael Sorkin that indeed a space-time with a horizon is actually a causal set, and the horizon entropy counts the links, that is, those irreducible causal relations which straddle the horizon. So here's a strategy. We take a causal set, which we've gotten by sprinkling into some space-time. We just count the links across the horizon in the vicinity of a hypersurface sigma and see whether we get, in the limit of the large area, for all causal horizons, this something goes like this. Yes.
In the Minkowski case, the duality of each point is actually going to be infinite, right?
Yes.
In Minkowski space.
Yes.
And that's very sensitive to the infrared boundary condition. So I guess the question is this finite and is it really local or is it sensitive?
Good.
And even infinite.
Good. Yes, exactly. I'll come to that in the next slide. So this is what you would like. You would like the average of this number, just counting the links across the horizon, to always be equal to this. The area in fundamental units times by some constant C, which is the same for all horizons. It's crucial that this is the same for all horizons because we know that the answer is A over 4 in Planck units. And this would tell us the relationship between the Planck length and the ratio between the Planck length and the fundamental length. This is in 4 dimensions. You'd have a similar one for different dimensions. Yes?
Yeah, I'm a bit confused. So since you don't have a sort of continuum theory to start with, a priori, you might not end up with Einstein-Hilbert action, in which case the entropy doesn't have to be the area. We know that from other considerations. Mm-hmm. So if you're just counting links across causal horizons and we're getting the area, isn't that over-considering the theory? I mean, the entropy doesn't have to be it's some geometric functional of curvature, but it doesn't have to be the area of the horizon. Right?
Yes, it might be, you'll see, it might be that the proposal that I'm making is actually tied to the action being the Einstein-Hilbert action, approximately.
Given a causal set, do you know how to calculate the area? I mean, could you take this as a definition of area?
It might turn out to be that way. You'll see. It might be that that's what actually, in this proposal that I'm making, it might actually be what we're doing. You'll see. Yeah, let me go on. Okay. All right. But, as Joe said, this non-locality makes this problem extremely challenging, and indeed the answer that you get naturally is infinite, which is the wrong answer. So, because of the non-locality, first of all, it's difficult to do what we want, which is localize the counting to a neighborhood of this intersection between sigma and h. That's the first thing. And it's challenging to do so in a way that is inherent in the causal structure and not, it doesn't impose any, you're not putting in the answer that you want, if you like, and gives you a finite answer. Okay, so Raphael and Jamal suggested one scheme to do this sort of effective localization. But what I'm going to show you is a new proposal. And that is based on recent development, which is that we have an action for causal sets. We have an action in each dimension. Okay. All right. Now, I'm just going to pluck this from the air and not give you, I'm looking at Harvey, not give you the whole background. So this just, as far as you're concerned, this comes from nowhere, right? So I apologize. Okay. So we have an action for a causal set, any causal set. It doesn't have to be a sprinkling into a two-dimensional space from now. Any causal set at all. But the action is associated with dimension two. So this is a two-dimensional action, but the causal set is not is any causal set. It doesn't have to be two. What it is this sum of numbers with alternating signs with different integer rational coefficients. And what are these numbers? N is the number of causal set elements. So N1 is the number of links. N2 is the number of three chains. It's the number of sets, subsets of the causal set with three elements, such that their causal relations are like this, and such that if you take the bottom element and the top element, this one is the only one that's causally between them. So this is a causal interval, and the causal interval is a three chain. You count the number of those. Right, that's N2. And then you count the number of, that's N2. And then you count the number of four chains, which are causal intervals. Again, between this one and this one, there can only be two elements. And add it to the number of diamonds, which again are causal intervals. So that these two causal sets have the property that between the top and the bottom points, there are two elements. Right. And those two elements can either be causally related or causally unrelated. Okay. You count the number of those things, that's N3. And then you add them together with these numbers. And you multiply by some order one number, unknown order one number. That's familiar in two-dimensional graphs. Okay. The four-dimensional one is pretty similar. There's some number of order one. This is the number of elements, the number of links, the number of three chains, the number of these things. And then this is the number of five-element causal sets, which are the analog of these. But now you allow three elements in between the top and the bottom. And this number we can specify is related to the ratio of the fundamental length and the Planck length. There are causal set actions in all other dimensions. They have the same form. The one in three dimensions involves only N, N1, N2, and N3. The one in five dimensions involves N1 up to N4. So they come in pairs. And we have reason to believe that the average over sprinklings into a manifold MG of this action, say this one, four-dimensional one, is related to the continuum action. In particular, in the continuum limit, if you do this thing and take the average, then in the continuum limit, it is the Einstein-Hilbert action plus boundary term. Yeah.
So what about the cosmological constant term?
Good. So the cosmological constant term is this N term. It's N, so it's just a number times the volume. So N is the volume. It's the number of elements is the volume. So if you want to add a cosmological constant, you just change this coefficient from 1/2 to some other number, and that you get a cosmological constant.
Don't you induce one in the continuum even if you didn't have one to begin with?
This is kinematics. So there's no quantum dynamics here.
Well, talking about an action and what comes out of what kind of action you have in some continuum limit, you have stuff dynamics.
By continuum limit, I don't mean physical continuum approximation to the fundamental theory. I just mean that you do the sprinkling at higher and higher density. So it's a kinematical statement. You take your space time, you choose some density. You do this sprinkling process, that's a random process. This action is a random variable, right? So for each run, you calculate if it's a number. You average over all the runs, and that gives you some number. And then you do it as a higher density, and a higher density, and a higher density. And in the continuum limit, we haven't proved, but we believe that in the continuum limit, this is what you get. And this, plus boundary terms, which are all crucial.
And is H bar designed to make the action dimensionless, or
yes,
do you want to
match
it up with the continuum? Is there micro-symmetry to do there, right?
Yes, I just divide it by h bar to make it dimensionless, and this is chosen. This number here is chosen to give you this. So, as you take the density to infinity, L, the fundamental length is going to zero. You keep this fixed. So this coefficient here is going to zero.
What's R? Curvature.
Sorry, again.
What is R? The curvature?
Yes, it's the scale curve.
But I mean, how is it computed? Or is...
How do you compute the scalar curvature of a quadrature? I can tell you, can I tell you that after?
Yes.
Okay. So what happens if you evaluate that action for some random Bessel set?
You just get garbage.
Does it fluctuate rapidly?
About... What,
Well, I mean, presumably the hope is that you want to suppress the contribution of the garbage.
Good.
And that suppression should come from some quick
question. And a related question is there a measure on the set of causal order that you need to use?
There's a sort of natural one, which is just one for each sort of isomorphism class of directed acyclic graphs. So, I mean, what you do when they're automorphisms, when an individual graph has an automorphism, how you deal with that issue is an ambiguity. But those are so rare that choosing different weights for that case is probably not going to affect the overall.
But I mean, it's going to affect the rapid fluctuation issue. Perspective.
These are all incredibly interesting fundamental questions, which I'm not going to address at all. Okay, so let's go on. Now, this action is non-local, highly non-local, because this is local. That's the only local term. The number of links is a non-local quantity. These are all non-local things. But it's bi-local. And I have to say, it's nice. It's a blast from the past for me. The first time I came to Santa Barbara was when I was a student, and we were all working on wormholes. And wormholes have a bi-local, induce a bi-local term in the action. However, the bi-localness was very, very mild in the sense that there was no correlation between the endpoints of the wormhole. Here, they're highly, highly correlated. So the bi-localness is not... it's not a wormhole-like bilocalness, but it's a fundamental bilocalness. Okay. So that means that if you have a causal set which you partition into two pieces, the action is not a sum of the action of one piece and the sum of the action of the other piece.
X and Y
are
disjoint.
Yes, X and Y
are
disjoint.
Yes,
it's a partition. All right. And I can define the difference, the failure of this additivity of the action, the failure of the locality of the action. And I define for each, the two subregions of the causal set, I define this curly I, xy, to be the sum of the actions of each two pieces minus the action of the whole causal set. And then I just normalize it like this. And if you compare that to something called the mutual information, which is the difference in the sum of the entropies of two systems minus and the entropy of the joint system, then, well, we call this, because of this comparison, we call this thing, we called it the space-time mutual information. That's just a name. It doesn't say that this is a mutual information. It just says it looks like it. Okay, so we just called it the space-time mutual information. Okay. All right. So here's the conjecture. Here, this is a causal set. And this H is not a surface in the causal set, it's just a partition. So it just means that there are some elements here and some elements here. And there's a hypersurface sigma, and that just means that there are some elements to the past of sigma and some elements to the future of sigma. We look at the part of the causal set that's just to the past of sigma, and then H divides it into two, X and Y. And the proposal is that the space-time mutual information I of X, Y is equal to the entropy of the horizon on sigma. That's the idea. So what is this space-time mutual information? What does it look like? Well, in two dimensions, the local term vanishes because the local term is additive. Right? So all you're left with is the non-local term, including the links, which are not included in X individually or Y individually, and they have to be the links which start at Y and end in X. Okay? So you count the number of links which whose bottom point is in Y and whose top point is in X, and that's the number of those is N1. The number of three chains whose bottom point is in Y and whose top point is in X is N2, etc. Right. So this is the space-time mutual information of X, Y in the two-dimensional case. The four-dimensional one, it has these different coefficients here. And I've just chosen, somewhat arbitrarily, the normalization of this thing I've called the space-time mutual information, so that the number of links has coefficient 1. And that's just because of this background idea that we're counting the number of links. Okay. So the idea is that this thing, this space-time mutual information, does indeed count links. There are infinitely many of them that go from Y to X. And that's physically, it's not doing the thing you want it to do. So we need to cancel off the overcounting. And the cancelling off the overcounting is what these terms is what this whole thing does. Okay. All right. So does it work, the conjecture? Does it give, on average, for all causal horizons in the limit of large horizon area, this? Right, where this number can depend on the dimension, but it must be the same for all causal horizons in fixed dimension.
So the fact that it truncated was some approximation, or there's some fundamental reason?
Finitely many of these in N4.
It turns out, so for that I'd have to explain why the actions were the way they were.
They also were not truncated.
They were truncated.
They were truncated, yes. But not approximations to something.
They were not approximations to something. So it just turned out that's what you need. It's what you need to give you the scalar curve, the Ricci curvature, the Ricci scalar. It's just what you need. So yeah, fine. And then does it fail to give this to surfaces that are not causal horizons? Okay, so I'm not sure whether this is actually necessary, but it would somehow be nice. Okay, so here are results. If anyone went to the Pacific Coast Gravity meeting, David Rideout presented these results there, so you may have seen these graphs before. Okay. I didn't show very well at all. Okay. So what is this? We calculated the space-time mutual information just numerically for Rindler horizons and decision horizons in three dimensions. And here is the data. The actual straight line, which is the straight line which shows whether or not the data is scaling in the right way, in other words, it's giving you something which is proportional to the length of the horizon. Can't see, I'm sorry, but if you drew a line by eye through this red data and then shifted it down slightly so it's kind of in slightly in between the red data and the green data, that would be a straight line of the right slope. And the red data is Rindler, and that obviously sort of looks it looks kind of the best. And the green and the blue are both De Sitter, where we've changed the cutoff. So they're just different cutoffs around a region around the De Sitter horizon. Okay. Now, I would say that this data is consistent with, it's not inconsistent with the conjecture that these are all asymptoting to a single straight line and of the same slope, and it's literally the same line. To be the same line is the statement that the coefficient is universal. So if they were scaling in the right way, but one was down here and the other was up there, that would mean that the scaling was right, but the coefficient in front of the area was different for different horizons. So that would make this proposal highly disfavored. And the coefficient, this C, which tells you the ratio between the Planck length and the fundamental length, is indeed of order 1. And there's some uncertainty because it's not clear exactly where this straight line should be drawn. If, but again, and I've kind of just invented this number of 10%, it depends whether or not you believe that they do scale in. To get a number like this, you have to assume that they are scaling in the right way, and then you can estimate what the number is. If you're also fitting to the scaling, then this number becomes much more uncertain. Right? Are there questions about this data?
So right now you're using the area as computed in the continuum space-time that you're sort of sprinkling.
Exactly.
There's no independent definition of the area in your causal set.
That's right. Yeah. And it may be that all we're doing is we're showing that we can calculate that. We have a microscopic way to calculate that area. Yes. Okay. So these are four. This is 4D results. These are 4D data. Here you can see the straight line fit a little better. It's the yellow line. The Rindler data has this weird bump, and that makes me doubt that the Rindler data, even though after the bump is over, it looks like it's doing very, very well. Yeah, this is just so weird. I don't really know what to make of it. So you can just, if you like, just ignore the red data. But then we can do two other cases. One is De Sitter, and there's three sets of data again with where we varied the cutoff. So those are, I don't know, blue, magenta, and cyan. You can't really distinguish them too well, but they are. It's consistent with them asymptoting to this yellow line. But we can do another case in four dimensions, which is what we call the collapsing shell. So what is that? That's a dynamical horizon, which is literally just the future light cone of a single point in Minkowski space-time. And that does pretty well too. So there, here we have those are the black data points. Okay. So again, I would say that this, and again, the coefficient is of order 1, which is necessary. It's of order 1. And I would say, again, the data is consistent with the proposal, the conjecture, that this space-time neutral information counts is giving something proportional to the area with a universal coefficient. Right. So I would say that this raises more questions than gives answers. So here are some of them. Why is it working, if it is working? It looks to me as if it's working well. It must be effectively localizing at the horizon, even though the definition is so highly global and non-local. And just to emphasize how good how well it's doing, in these largest causal sets, there are 2 to the 20 elements. That's roughly a million elements. Okay. And the number of links in a causal set of roughly a million elements is about the number of links goes like n to the 3/2, right? So that's a billion. There are a billion links. So the numbers in that space-time mutual information thing, the numbers here are of order a billion. But the area is of order the square root of n, which is 1,000. So you've got cancellation of order of magnitude of 6, right? So you've got numbers which are billions big, and they cancel so beautifully to give you numbers of order 1,000. that's how good it is. That's how well it is. All right. So it's some, in some sense, is it counting the links close to the intersection of the horizon and sigma with cancellations? Okay. Well, what about surfaces which are not horizons? When the boundary surface between x and y is time-like, we've done some simulations of that, the space-time mutual information is like the codimension 1 volume of the surface in between x and y. So we can simulate something like this. Just take a cuboid and divide it down here. So this is my sigma. And y, if you calculate space-time mutual information like that, you get not the area of this, but the volume of that. However, when the boundary surface between x and y, between x and y is space-like, we have preliminary evidence that we get the wrong right answer. Meaning it's the right, meaning that it's the area of the intersection, but that's, which is the, kind of the right answer, but it's the wrong answer, the answer we don't want, I think. So it's sort of a failure in some way that you get something proportional to the area, but you don't want it to be, or you don't need it to be proportional to the area. Okay. So a null surface that's not a horizon, we could also simulate that. So thanks to Don and Harvey, I now know a nice example of one that that's relatively easy to try. So we could try that. And again, we kind of like it to fail, but the above idea is that you're effectively localizing that the depth that would suggest that it's going to work for this as well. What conclusion would one draw if it also fails to fail? If you're getting something proportional to the area, is that a bad thing?
Okay. Ben?
Yes?
I thought you'd already done something that wasn't really a horizon. You said you did this case that was the light coming from the origin, collapsing shell.
Ah, that is...
I don't put the shell in, that's not the horizon.
But it could be.
It could be, but it isn't.
So you better get the... right. I think that is a horizon.
There. If it worked there, I think it probably will work for null surfaces.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You could be right. Yeah. All right. But underlying all of this speculation here, is that we need to show that there is an actual entropy that is equal to this quantity. This quantity is just it's just kinematical, right? It doesn't have any dynamics behind it. So if it's behaving in the right way, then that's its motivation to look for something that's dynamically an entropy and is equal to this quantity and numerically equal to this quantity. So there are hints that this space-time mutual information is entropy-like, right? So what are those hints? Well, they're a bit weak, I have to say, but one is that it just looks like a mutual information. Right? That's all you can say. And then the other thing is that it does look like an information flow across H. It really has to do with stuff flowing over the horizon. These links, these causal relations that straddle the horizon. Okay. All right. So the big question is there some counting of quantum states or an entanglement entropy or something of that sort that is numerically equal to the space-time mutual information? Most importantly, we would have to prove a generalized second law from microscopic quantum theory. And note that this is something that has to be done in any approach, and it's something that's mostly ignored. If anyone claims that they've counted the entropy of a black hole in some quantum theory of gravity, you have to ask them, can you prove the generalized second law with your entropy? And if you can't, then it doesn't yet deserve the title of entropy. Okay, and finally, I'll just end by saying that trying to prove a generalized second law, perhaps motivated by or with this space-time mutual information as a guide, might lead us to a fully space-time or history, some of the history, quantum mechanical understanding of entropy. It's something that Jim and Murray Gell-Mann have thought about in the past, and Graphar's talking too. And this ideas might be a guide to reaching such a such an understanding, a fundamental understanding of entropy and quantum gravity. And I will end there. Thank you.
I mean, your third and fourth point, I mean, to me, looks actually what you defined may be taken as being the area, and not the, so you would like to show that it behaves like entropy, which is your fourth point, that you really have a microscopic picture which explains this entropy. But if it's only the area you have defined, then I don't think that's a problem that for another null surface it would work. What you would like not to work is the fourth thing,
yes,
that you have a microscopic explanation there.
That's possible. But
so there's no worry that if
yes,
it would be a formula that still computes the area for the surface, it's basically because you defined something that's the area.
Yes. So why is it the area? That's the. I mean, it's something which you didn't put the area in any way at all. It's some. It's something which is connected to the action. It's something which is highly global. It's some kind of, you know.
But the fact
that I'm reminded of the Chern-Gaspinet theorem, which computes a topological quantity as an area. And I mean, and in topology, the same sort of thing happens where you can have huge numbers of elements, and then you take an alternating sum and you have a topological number. I mean, it's really reminiscent.
It is reminiscent of that. And in fact, I mean, just to mention, we have looked at the two-dimensional, the two-dimensional action. So we've actually looked at the two-dimensional action and studied it for two-dimensional space-time. Of course, usual Gaspinet is usually Euclidean, right? So here we're fully Lorentzian, it's all good, right? But you could say, in what sense is this object logical? It's incredibly interesting. It's topological, but not in a sort of Gaspinet way. So, can I tell you about it? So in two dimensions, this is all in flat space, right? So it's all flat. If you take a causal interval and you sprinkle into it some density, you calculate the space time mutual information, take its average. For any density at all, the average is 1/2. Sorry, not the action, but I'm talking about the action there. So that action, that thing. Any density at all. Okay, so here, but let's say we divide up that interval into four pieces like that, okay? Well, the action of this is 1/2, the action of that is 1/2, and the action of that is 1/2, and that's 1/2, which seems to be contradicted by this. But of course, it's non-local. No, it's non-local. So what you have to do is add in the extra pieces that you've neglected, the non-local pieces that count the links between here and here, here and here, here and here. Okay. And it turns out that the contribution at an edge like that is -1/2. And the contribution of a vertex like that, in other words, this missing information from here to here, is +1/2. Right, so this is an edge. Let me call this a face. Well, and you can divide this up any way you like this, blah, blah, blah. So any kind of null tiling that you'd like to make. And the answer will always, the action of this will always be a half because it's just the order.
Yeah.
It also fits with Einstein overbeing topological reproductions.
Yeah, in some way, except it's Lorentzian.
I mean, there's another way that one could understand the appearance of this area. So if I take any quantum field theory, you can always compute the mutual information between two regions, and if they're truly disjoint regions, then that's a UV finite quantity. But if the two regions share a boundary, then there's a UV divergence. So what that means is that if you calculate in quantum field theory the mutual information between two regions, then it's equal to the area of the part of the intersection in units of the cutoff. Okay. And moreover, I mean, so I think the thing that's sort of surprising is that you get the same coefficient when you calculate the area of the horizon in units of the cutoff. But I think, for example, in conformal field theory, there is a universal coefficient when you calculate the mutual information in units of the cutoff, and that coefficient is the central charge. Presumably, these all become continuum quantum field theories in the infrared, and so that C might be a central charge.
That would be incredibly interesting. So Raphael has been looking at putting the quantum field theory on a Kolb set and computing an entanglement entropy. So the Kolb set sort of provides you with this cutoff, right? So it provides you.
So the fact that it's proportional to the area is nothing more, nothing less than. I mean, that's something totally generic that I think we should expect. The fact that it's proportional to the area and units of the cutoff.
Okay. But it doesn't work for this. It doesn't work for this thing. But you could do the same thing here. Right?
Let's see. If I had a local quantum field theory, then the entanglement entropy would be the area and units of the cutoff.
Right.
At least that would be the leading contribution.
Yeah. So you have some hypercircuits. Your entanglement entropy is defined in this hypercircuit. This is a mysterious sort of fully space-time quantity, which has to do with these whole space-time regions.
Because it's a Lorentzian. Okay. I mean, I'm of course thinking about a kind of Euclidean or static configuration.
What you just said makes it puzzling why it works at all, because I mean, suppose you have a Killing horizon. Wouldn't you get a divergence from the interesting angle of the Killing direction? Since it's a space-time calculus, I mean, have an infinite number of copies of each region.
The input to her calculation was both the horizon and some cross-section of it.
Ah.
You do put a cross-section in
there. Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry.
It seems to be past.
Okay.
I mean, of course, the calculations we actually did are all finite memory. I mean, the proposal is that you calculate this thing for the full past of this horizon sigma. Right? We can't obviously say that that's it. So we have some cutoff in the past too.
And when you get the case where your sort of horizon was space-like,
yes.
And you have another cutoff, so you have another space-like surface,
yes.
And you assume they just intersect somewhere?
Yes, or? That's right. So I should really, should I get rid of this now?
Yeah. If you chose them to be the same surface, would you still get the area? Or you get something more?
What we actually do is, for Rindler, we just take a cuboid in four dimensions, and we take the following null plane for the horizon calculation, the actual Rindler horizon calculation, and we call this y and this x, and we calculate the space-time mutual information between those two things. There are all sorts of things I'm sweeping under the rug here, anyway. And this is the area that we, this is sigma, right, and this is some past cutoff. Right, sigma prime. Right. You might notice that this picture is time reversal symmetric. In fact, the space-time mutual information is also time reversal symmetric. So if you get something proportional to this, it should also be counting something here as well. So in fact, we have evidence that you do get contribution from here and from here. But the reason you get the contribution from here is because you've got this cutoff here. So if you took the cutoff, if you took this away, then you would just get that one. Okay. Right, so for the space-like one, we just make this space-like. So we just choose a space-like surface here. Keep the y is to the past of the space-like surface, x is to the future of the space-like surface. And preliminary investigations in three dimensions show that we can get something proportional to this area. It's a length in three dimensions. Yeah. But that's the evidence. Yeah.
So
since you've got this page up again, in the four-dimensional case, first of all, well, there isn't a known topological invariant that's matching. And I wanted to come back to this question of the cosmological constant. You might think, say, sprinkling more and more points is somehow a little bit like, renormalization group flow or something. But I'm wondering, why you're not getting what looks like a cosmological constant in the continuum limit. And for example, if I change the coefficient of n up there by a tiny amount, then I would have a constant. So it's precisely that coefficient that gives you no cosmological constant for all any density of points.
And there's a lot of mess contained in this in here because. For this to work for causal sets, what we need is not just that we get something that's like the Einstein-Hilbert action in the continuum limit, but at some finite scale. So you don't actually take continuum limit, but you just stop at some scale. And then we'd like this to approximate this. And I have to say that we don't have any theorem about that, so I'm not so confident about that, actually.
Is there numerical evidence on that? What is the reason you have to believe?
It's a theorem that, so you can think of this object, this is the action, you can think of it as a sum over the causal set of a certain sort of Lagrangian density, okay? And we can prove that Lagrangian density in the continuum limit tends to the scalar curvature. Okay, so we can prove that. But we don't have any handle on when the limit sets in. So we don't know. We don't have any handle on when on what scale, what density of sprinkling you need in order to get approximately the limiting value. That's what we're failing to get.
Actually, related question. I mean, do you have an intuition why you need to go to higher chains to get the Einstein-Hilbert term in different dimensions? I might have thought that you could just stick to N3, and if it works in two dimensions, the same thing would work in all dimensions. I mean, I don't see why increasing chain length is crucial to get the correct continuum limit to Einstein-Hilbert term.
Yes. So I had some slides on it, which I deleted because I thought no one wants to see those. So why do you need extra terms in higher dimensions?
Well, you need to probe extra dimensions, right? I mean, you cannot have a three-node chain with probe all four dimensions.
Why? Can I explain this in some?
Related question, what are these numbers for? Did you fit them just by numerics, or?
No, you fit them analytically. All of this comes from studying a discrete version of the Dahlenbergian. So we can try and figure out a discrete Dahlenbergian operator on scalar fields on a causal set. Okay. And the trouble with the Dahlenbergian, the trouble with that, obviously, is that the Dahlenbergian is a local thing, but the causal set is highly non-local. And there are infinitely many nearest neighbors to a given point. So when you take differences of the value at the point and the value at the nearest neighbor, you've got infinitely many nearest neighbors to deal with. And they should all be treated on the same footing because they're all equivalent to each other as far as the causal set is concerned, as far as the graph is concerned. They're equally close to this point. So you have to actually, you take the value at the point and then you subtract the sum of the values of all of the nearest neighbors, right? And that's, but there's infinitely many of them, so that's obviously bad. But you cancel them off partially, and then by then adding the values at all the next nearest neighbors. And then that's not quite right either, so then you have to add in, subtract off again, the sum of the next nearest neighbors. And you adjust the coefficients in exactly the same way that you do when you're dealing with a lattice theory. You just choose the coefficients to do the right job of cancelling off the coefficients to give you the Dahlenbergian, and the way you do it.
And so why does it stop?
Why didn't you require n sub m for all n?
Yes, I'm afraid I'll have to show you the calculation. So.
So in doing that procedure, what do you do about the conformal factor? Because that's not encoded in the causal set.
It is. It's encoded in the causal factor. It's encoded in the number of elements. That's it. You get that for free. You get it for free. It's there.
Can I ask, coming back to Mugun's earlier question, is it imaginable that if you add extra terms, you get higher derivative corrections and hence an entropy that's like a mold entropy?
Good. So if you don't take the continuum limit, then there will be higher terms already. And I'm pretty sure, although I haven't thought about it too carefully, but I'm pretty sure that there will be other actions in two dimensions, let's say four, there will be other actions in four dimensions with more terms that would also do the job of giving you this in the continuum limit. But the corrections would then be different. So if you took the difference of those two actions, then you could cancel off this leading term and pick up the higher derivative. I'm pretty sure about that. However, those terms will be suppressed, they'll be the usual arguments, they'll be suppressed by the fundamental scale. And so then you're getting into the murky territory of, those terms will only be significant compared to this term. They'll only be significant on scales, if the curvature is varying on Planckian scales. And then this whole scenario is going to basically, the fundamental scenario is going to break down. And mathematically, I think if you literally take a continuum limit, and you don't restrict yourself to scales larger than the fundamental scale, you literally take the continuum limit, then you can do that. But physically, I'm not sure that those higher derivatives are going to work.
No, but what you said is that an experiment could be that by choosing, well, maybe adding more terms and then tuning the coefficients, you could get rid of that term. So you have an action where the leading term, say, is r squared. And then you can investigate these entropy properties and see, are we getting something now that's proportional to a curvature? Mm-hmm. Where the leading term is the curvature. Mm-hmm. So that might give you some insight into what's going on. But that you would be not to keep this that you worked so hard for. But yeah, to tune that one out.
That would be an interesting thing to do in Harvard.
Yeah. Another question. First time frame.